Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, proudly presented by Butler Snow, where we cover topics of interest to lawyers handling appellate matters in Texas courts and beyond. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Jody Sanders.
And I'm Todd Smith.
And our guest today is Kelly Morris, who is at Wright Close in Houston, a place where we have many friends and some past podcast guests. Kelly, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And I know you haven't been there long. Let's talk about kind of your background for some of our listeners who may not know you. Just kind of tell us a little bit about yourself and where you come from and sort of your path into the law.
Sure. So I am the child of two CPAs turned lawyers who at one point actually had their own law firm, Clark and Clark, my maiden name. I grew up in Austin and Fort Worth. So depending on the circumstances, I will give you one of those answers. Graduated from high school in Fort Worth, went to college at UT, realized my sophomore year that I did not want to go to medical school, and got talked into law school by my mother, which was something they had always told us, never consider, do not go to law school, and ended up following in her footsteps and going to Baylor for law school with the intention of being an appellate lawyer. So I'm a big nerd, and my mom actually sold me on law school with the idea of being an appellate attorney. And so that was what I went into law school with and kind of focused my experiences and schedule on what would prepare me best to be an appellate lawyer. And I followed up after graduation with a clerkship at the Texas Supreme Court, which I think Todd did that as well. So I'm part of the elusive group of BAs, briefing attorneys. I clerked for Justice Paul Green, who was a guest on the show a few years ago, and then went to Bracewell in Houston as my first law firm job. And I've been in Houston ever since, so almost 10 years now.
Well, before we go too far, I know you didn't go to TCU, but you have a TCU connection that I think is pretty cool. And since we're two Horned Frog hosts on this podcast, maybe you'd share it.
My mother's parents actually met at TCU right before World War II. And my grandfather was the cornerback for the TCU football team at that time, which until fairly recent history was known as the best football team in the history of the program. And so he was on the Orange Bowl team. And when he would come to visit, we would get to go to the Letterman Club in the stadium. And it was just, even though my parents didn't go to TCU, I grew up a little bit of a Horned Frog fan. And also, I'm sure as Jody knows, living in Fort Worth, it's hard to not be a TCU fan.
Well, that's a really cool connection. Yeah. I mean, those are some historic teams, and I'm glad that we've made some new history in recent times, but yeah, that's fantastic to have that experience.
I also wanted to talk about kind of your Supreme Court clerkship, both maybe just share your general experience, and then you actually were there at kind of an interesting year too. So maybe hear a little bit about that experience too.
Sure. So when I was in law school, like I said, I originally was only focused on appellate. Maybe in a little bit, we'll touch on my detour into the world of trial law, but I was looking only to do an appellate clerkship, so focused primarily on applying for Supreme Court positions and Fifth Circuit positions, and fortunately got an offer to work for Justice Green. And let's see, so Justice Green at the time was the third most senior judge on the court. I think we've had guests before talking about the Texas Supreme Court clerkship experience, but one thing that's really unique about it for recent law school grads is that you have a big group of clerks that all start on the same day and end on the same day. And you really are like a class of clerks for all the court. Everyone is together all the time. It doesn't really matter which judge you work for. It's just a big group of clerks, which is very different than a lot of other clerkship experiences. At the time, each judge had two clerks. Now some are opting for three. So there was 18 of us fresh out of law school, and those are some of my closest friends still to this day. About a month into my clerkship, so September 2013, Chief Justice Wallace Jefferson announced his retirement from the court. So we were all fresh on the court. Everyone was like, what does this mean for us? What do we do? Especially his two clerks. But the governor worked very quickly to appoint a replacement judge. And that was when Justice Jeff Brown was appointed to the court. And Chief Justice Hecht was named as the chief. So we had a lot of swearing in, I guess, a lot of investitures that year, which was exciting. As a clerk, you get to go to the Capitol and witness it. Justice Scalia swore in Chief Justice Hecht. And so we got to do a meet and greet with him as the law clerks.
Hard to believe that's been 10 years ago. It doesn't seem like it was that long ago to me. But to hear you say September 2013, wow.
It is a really cool experience to participate in investitures, or even as an observer. Always, when certainly when we've got a Supreme Court justice being invested, but also, as you said, Justice Scalia coming over. This is one of those very ceremonial experiences that I think for lawyers generally, it's something that people don't really think about that much unless they're part of the appellate bar or local to Austin or have some relationship with the judges. But I always enjoy it when I get the chance to go over and observe. And it's done in the Senate chamber, as I recall. So it's a pretty cool experience.
Yes, all the clerks crowding on the balcony in the Senate chamber to watch. Mm-hmm. And then one of the other neat things about when those two investitures happened is that Justice Brown's investiture was in early November. And that was right after we'd gotten our past results from the bar. My parents were able to come up to the courthouse and Justice Green swore me in the Supreme Courtroom. And it was the same day as the investiture. So everybody was already all dressed up and there was a big reception. So it was almost like we had our own little private party our swearing in for the bar.
Oh, funny. Yeah, that's awesome.
That's really neat.
So I have to ask you something. You mentioned everybody starting at the same time, your class of clerks. I recall, you know, my class of clerks doing that too. And I recall getting a rather stern talking to on day one by the then clerk of the Supreme Court, that was two clerks ago. So, and we've seen and heard a lot in the news in recent times, including some legislation about maintaining the confidentiality of court work product in advance of its release. Does that still happen? Does Blake take you guys aside and say, hey, here's the deal. Don't you dare leak an opinion?
We definitely had a talking to the first day. I can't remember if it was Blake or the counsel for the court, but there was definitely a talk. One of the things I remember being stressed is that the clerks you're never to say that you wrote an opinion because you did not actually write it, even if helped to draft it. It's right. The court's opinion. And so if a case comes up and so each judge handles drafting opinions differently. And Justice Green, we split our opinions pretty evenly between the clerks to draft the first round. Some of the judges take their own first rounds, but Justice Green had us write it. So there were opinions published that I did a lot of the work on and knew those cases very well. But which ones came from me, which ones came from my co-clerk, which ones came from the staff attorney, that's something that has to stay inside the court. So that was my biggest takeaway. And also, yes, just generally, any case that's pending or even after it's been decided, how the sausage gets made is something that we do not talk about. I remember over the holidays, I went on a ski trip and I had printed out a binder for one of the cases I was working on. And I fortunately didn't put anything in the cover of the binder, so it didn't say what case it was. But I'm sitting there in the airport in Phoenix between flights and somebody sits down next to me and starts chatting, and it turns out they're a lawyer in Texas and they have a case pending in the Texas Supreme Court. And I'm like hiding my binder. And so it's just one of those first moments where I really realized like these cases are real people and real lawyers out there. Mm-hmm. And you never know where you're going to run into someone. And that also translated well into practice.
Providing surety bonds for court-related matters is a very niche industry. And there are very few appeal bond specialists who are as experienced as Court Surety Bond Agency. Whether the client is a sophisticated entity or an individual involved in litigation for the first time, CSBA uses its more than 110 years of combined surety experience handling appeal bonds to provide first-class service to its clients. For more information, visit courtsurety.com.
Practice learning confidentiality and privilege and what you can and can't just talk about in casual conversation mm-hmm. with people.
That's certainly become a big item of discussion in the last couple of years, too. In fact, I don't know if it passed or not. Todd, do you know if they passed that bill in the legislature about criminalizing releasing, you know, judicial materials?
I want to say it did, but yeah. I can't recall. I know it got really far in the process. Mm-hmm. And, well, my own opinion is other things probably should have taken priority over that. But I don't know the answer for sure.
Yeah, I don't either. We'll have to wait for Jerry Bullard to come back.
That's right.
Tell us the answer.
That's right.
So from the Supreme Court, you've had an interesting career. So you started out in big law. Did you immediately move into appellate straight out of your Supreme Court clerkship?
No. So at Bracewell in Houston, which was where I started, I was officially in the litigation section, although appellate kind of falls within litigation. I was on the same floor as the two appellate legends at Bracewell, Jeff Oldham and Warren Harris. And I did get to do work for them here and there where they needed assistance. But I was officially working in one of the trial groups that did a lot of patent litigation. So that was very different than what I had done at the Texas Supreme Court. I got thrown into a patent infringement lawsuit in Marshall, Texas, and I got to go to trial about 6 months in front of Judge Rodney Gilstrap. So that was a very exciting experience. My role on the team, I've now kind of realized I really was the appellate attorney on the team, as much as you can be as a second year associate. They had me doing a lot of the writing, kind of everyone else was engineers, or most people were, like, so put this in plain English. And I got to work hand in hand with Jeff Oldham on the jury charge. When that case went to trial, he had something that was a little more important going on. He was arguing a case in the U.S. Supreme Court. And so I got to go to that case go to trial as the appellate lawyer, which in hindsight is mind-boggling that a second-year associate would be handling a lot of the error preservation issues in a big federal case. But that was a really great experience. Unfortunately, it didn't go so well for our clients. But I got my feet wet right away in Marshall. And then about a little over a year later, I'd been at Bracewell just shy of 2 years. I started thinking I wanted to be somewhere a little smaller so I could get more of that hands-on experience. I realized that my trial experience right off the bat was not necessarily the norm there. And so I ended up going to Gray, Reed & McGraw, which is a mid-sized firm, technically three offices, Houston, Dallas, and Waco. And again, I was officially a litigation associate, but they had recently brought in Justice Jim Mosley in the Dallas office, and Dylan Drummond was also mm-hmm. in the Dallas office. And so we were trying to kind of build up an appellate practice. And so I got to work on more and more appeals. And somewhere along the lines, I realized that what I wanted to do was to be an appellate attorney, but doing a lot of the work embedded in trial. I liked mm-hmm. the dispositive motions, the error preservation, that type of mm-hmm. issues that come up in trial. I did not really like discovery, although to be fair, I don't think anyone does. and that what I had in my head, I guess I was a little confused as a young lawyer. I think I thought that appellate lawyers just sat and wrote opinions, briefs. They read the record, they wrote the briefs. Every once in a while, they get to argue a case. And while I really did enjoy that, I don't think anybody that goes into appellate law doesn't, on some level, enjoy research and writing. I wanted to see more action. And it took me a number of years before I realized that what I liked doing at trial is actually appellate work. And so that was where I ended up at about 8 years in, deciding that I definitely wanted to launch myself full-time into appellate work. And I had been preparing for several years to take the board certification exam as soon as I got the experience, and which I think we'll talk about in a little bit. But I was getting ready to take the exam. It was September of last year, of 2022, from the board exam, maybe less. And I had a very unique opportunity to do a federal clerkship that would start right away for Judge Lynn Hughes here in Houston in the Southern District. He had an immediate need for a law clerk. He had a clerk abruptly leave with about a year left in her term. So he had one clerk who was fresh out of law school and really needed somebody that could come in and start right away and had some idea about litigation and how things work. And so I talked to my husband because that is a crazy decision and I needed to make sure that he was on board with that. And went and interviewed with Judge Hughes the next day, got a phone call later that day offering me the job. And he wanted me to start immediately. And I said, can I wait 2 weeks until after the board certification exam? And he said, okay, if that's really what you want to do. I gave notice at my law firm that I was going to clerk, which was, as a ninth year associate, a very odd thing to do, but everybody was very supportive. And then tried to wrap up all my cases, including a Texas Supreme Court brief that was due the day before the board certification exam.
Oh my gosh.
And study as much as I could, and then turned in my laptop and drove to Austin to take the exam. And then the next week started my federal clerkship with Judge Hughes.
What a whirlwind. That seems like it was.
Absolutely. Glad to have those few weeks behind you.
Yes. I walked onto the board certification exam with no expectation of passing. At the very least, I thought it was great experience because then I could go into it the next year, eyes wide open, knowing exactly what the test was like. And I to say I was shocked when I got the email that I passed January was to say I was shocked would be an understatement. I think I actually, big crier, but I think I actually cried when I saw that email because it was such a surprise. And I knew that that would really set me up to do appeals exclusively when I finished my clerkship.
You mentioned going back as a ninth year attorney is not the traditional clerkship path. I mean, some people do go after a few years, but usually not that late. How was the experience transitioning from doing advocacy for that long to being on the court side again?
It was actually really nice. Not every clerkship is going to be like this, but Judge Hughes is very, I guess, old school is really an appropriate word for him. We did not email between the judge and the clerks. We did not have laptops. So it was hard work when I was in the office. But when I had to leave the office, I really left the office, which was, I appreciated that so much more after having been in practice that I could disconnect when I left work. It was really interesting seeing different styles of litigation. Unfortunately, no cases went to trial while I was there. As anybody who's practiced before Judge Hughes knows, he has lots of in-person hearings. He does not believe in Zoom, does not believe in phone conferences. So I got to see plenty of lawyers in person in the courtroom, lots of different styles. And there was definitely things where it's like, oh, I don't know if I would have done it that way. But there was other times where I was like, that was a great move. I'll have to keep that in mind. And especially coming at it from an appellate perspective and seeing how the orders get written and seeing the motion practice really helped me to understand what is going to be the most helpful for the trial judge to preserve error here, to get the exact ruling that you need. So that was a really helpful perspective. And also something that most people know, but is really reinforced when you're a clerk, is that the attorneys need to be nice and respectful to everybody that they encounter in the courthouse. Because when there are attorneys on a case that have a reputation for not being very nice to the court staff, that may or may not impact how the clerk feels about the case and how quickly they want to get the case resolved, or the case manager, because those case managers have a lot of control over the federal dockets. And so that's somebody that you definitely want to be friends with and not an enemy of.
Oh, that's definitely good advice. So when we first started talking about your federal clerkship, I was thinking, well, this is interesting. You come off a Supreme Court clerkship and had time in private practice and wanting to really focus on appellate work. So other than just the circumstances in which the clerkship came up, I was thinking, well, why district court? But the way that you, as opposed to say Fifth Circuit or another circuit court, but the way that you explained it, I think answered my question, because you mentioned really getting in tune with the kind of advocacy that appellate lawyers do in trial courts and what's effective and what's not. That really struck me. It makes a lot of sense to me now, especially because federal court is so paper intensive. and writing intensive as opposed to state court practice, how that experience could really help build your skill and help you understand even better what goes into being an effective appellate advocate in a trial court.
There was one other big learning point working for Judge Hughes, which I had the good fortune of working with some of his former clerks when I was at Gray Reitz. I knew what type of environment he had and his style. One of his jobs as a judge, he sees, is to train his law clerks how to write and train the lawyers. I'm sure that there's plenty of lawyers out there listening who have seen an order or something uploaded from Judge Hughes where he has taken a red pen to the draft order and changed things or struck out words that he thought were unnecessary. And so I really tried to go into the clerkship trying to learn and not be stuck in my ways, because I've done this for a number of years. I know what I'm doing. Just really wanted to learn everything that I could from him. He's a big fan of Brian Gardner, and he has thoughts on every single piece of writing that comes across his desk, no matter who wrote it. He'll even correct his own writing 10 different times before he can get it to the most succinct form of an order that is possible, for better or worse. So I think the clerkship also had a big impact on my writing. I considered myself to be a good writer going into it, but I definitely learned a lot from him. And I'm honored that I will have been one of his final clerks, because as most people know, he took senior status in February, which is why my clerkship was cut a little short. But I learned a lot from him. And then I also had the unique privilege of working for Judge Drew Tipton for my last couple months, who took over Judge Hughes's civil docket in Houston. And so I stayed with my cases that were transitioned to Judge Tipton and got to stay on those for a couple months and see how he did it. So not only did I get to learn about Judge Hughes, I got to learn a little bit about how Judge Tipton operates and what he likes and what he doesn't like in his writing style.
I'm wondering, you did a clerkship right out of law school and then you did one later in your career. Do you have kind of views on maybe the value of that experience for someone? I mean, would you say people should go right out of law school still and try and clerk? Or do you think it maybe helps to have a year or a couple of years of experience before trying to seek that out?
So this isn't directly an answer because it's not necessarily what I would recommend. But practically right now, if you want to do a Fifth Circuit clerkship and even some of the Texas Supreme Court clerkships, they are hiring several years out. Mm-hmm. So it is not necessarily feasible for someone to graduate from law school and go straight into a Fifth Circuit clerkship. And I think that's a good thing. That means that those people that are doing Fifth Circuit clerkships are being forced to either go work for a few years beforehand, or they line up a district court clerkship beforehand. And so they get to see more than one perspective. I think going straight to the Texas Supreme Court out of law school was a great experience for me. It really framed the way I approached the law. And the Texas Supreme Court clerkship is a really good one to do right out of law school. What you do at the Texas Supreme Court is similar to what you do in law school. It is your opinion writing, your memo writing, but along the same lines, the way you are taught to think in law school. District court clerkships are a completely different animal. My co-clerk was straight out of law school. He went to Emory. And the other clerks that I got to know in the courthouse, most of them were also straight out of law school. And never having tried a case or taken discovery, it would be so overwhelming to do a district court clerkship right out of law school. I know a lot of people do it. Most people do it and they do it very well. But I definitely felt like I was in a much better place to understand what was happening in the case, having gone through it myself. There's a lot of terminology that you don't necessarily learn in law school, particularly if you go out of state. And I think having that trial experience beforehand made me a better district court clerk. Here at Wright Close and Barger, I have several colleagues who went back to either a clerkship or a staff attorney position several years into practice. And to be honest, that was one of the things that attracted me to this firm, because I think the type of lawyer that would leave private practice and go back to clerk is the type of lawyer I would get along with, somebody who really enjoys legal reasoning and opinion writing and cares more about the work than necessarily the paycheck. And so at this point in my career, I see a big benefit to practicing before you clerk, not only because that is practically how it's happening nowadays, but I think it would also make you a better clerk, particularly with the district court clerkship. That said, it can be very challenging to go from private practice salary to clerking. And so you have to make sure that you are planning for that and that your support system is on board with that. I have two kids and a husband, and going back to clerk definitely meant some sacrifices for my family. And I had to make sure that everybody was on board with that before I went in for my interview.
And hopefully you'll get more than 2 weeks notice usually about your potential clerkship.
Yes, no doubt. And, about
I mean, I've seen people now that did district court clerkship and then they go work for their firm where they were summer associate.
When the stakes are high, decisions must be made quickly, and Court Surety Bond Agency is here to help. As the nation's leading surety agency specializing in supersedious bonds, CSBA can handle any size bond ranging from a small temporary injunction bond to a billion-dollar appeal bond. If your client needs protection against judgment enforcement, contact CSBA or visit courtsurety.com today.
For 1 year and then go back to their Fifth Circuit clerkship. Or there's all different combinations now because of how far out these appellate clerkships tend to be hiring. And so in that case, I think, yes, you appreciate, if you know you're going to be going back to clerking, you approach your year of working in a different light. You save that money, you get ready to go back into public service.
It seems like that the folks that are going back to clerk, they either know that they want to do high level appellate work and they're committed to the experience of getting that federal clerkship, or I've seen some, including I think your colleague Rafi Malkonian, who did it as kind of a reset and sort of pivoted to appellate practice from there, as I remember. I think it's awesome to go and do it. And I'm a little jealous of your experience clerking in a federal district court. What a great combination of experience for you and a great way to set yourself up for what certainly is shaping up to be a great career as an appellate lawyer with a great firm.
I think that's getting to be more and more common. You have to kind of fill the years beforehand, but in hindsight, those years that you fill are sometimes more helpful.
Well, another kind of question about your career. You've done big law, you did sort of mid-sized law, now you're doing a boutique. And I recognize you've only been there a month, but I'm just kind of curious your perspective on the different firms and kind of approaches and development of an appellate career in those types of places.
Well, that's a good question. Each of the three places I've been have been very different in terms of how they treat both litigation and the appellate practice. The mid-sized firm I worked for was very litigation focused. It was a full-service firm, but valued litigation more than some full service firms do. Bracewell has a top tier appellate group, but it is a very small group. So that's a different atmosphere than some of the other big firms that have appellate groups. Where I am now, right close, is only does trials and appeals. And there's kind of the downside to being at a boutique is that you don't have the opportunities for business development that you may have at a full service firm. Personally, that hasn't affected me much, but I can definitely see where if you're somebody at a firm where you're getting a lot of business from the transactional attorneys, you have a great client that the firm has worked to build a relationship over the years, and you're going to automatically be getting their appellate work. That's really nice to have. The other big advantage of being at a full service firm was when I had subject matter specific questions, and I could call up the transactional lawyer that did that exclusively. I could call up the oil and gas title lawyer. I could call the M&A lawyer, say like, am I using this phrase correctly? Or can you explain exactly how this deal would have happened and what this waterfall spreadsheet means, or all those other big words that are not things that I deal with on a daily basis. And so being now at a boutique, I have to kind of reach outside the firm if I want some of that advice. And you have to know how to ask those questions without breaching any type of privilege or revealing too much about the case. But we have a focus on trials and appeals, and that is a really fun place to work. We have all firm lunches where the young associates have to present Texas Supreme Court opinions that have been recently released to practice for oral argument, and they get peppered with questions by the partners. any type of appellate event going on in the state, pretty much, our firm will sponsor and you'll have the full support to go to it. You want to go downtown for the Houston Bar Association appellate luncheon, there's going to be a big group going. You want to speak on some topic somewhere, somebody at the firm's already done it and they can put you in touch with the right person. Being surrounded by lawyers with so many years of appellate experience and that have been involved with every level of bar association is just really makes it easy to do what I do. It's also just really fun to work with people who are as nerdy as I am. Most appellate lawyers are nerds, and that's okay. And just somebody to be surrounded by people who get as excited about things as I do is fun. Like, I got a new keyboard last week, a legal board. I don't know if y'all have heard of these. And I joked, this is the nerdiest purchase I've ever made, but it's going to change my life. And I could tell my coworkers about it, and they were just as excited as I was. I told my husband, and he was like, how much did you spend on that?
Yeah. I was just thinking it's kind of the epitome of appellate nerdiness for a firm to have all firm lunches in which there's a presentation on Texas Supreme Court cases. But how cool. I mean,
because yeah, even absolutely. If
you, you know, Friday comes around, especially this time of year, the orders list can be really long. And so it's hard to actually dive into all of the cases. But that's a really neat thing that you all do. We may need to steal that idea.
The other kind of fun or the other thing that's been really enjoyable at the firm, being at Wright, Close & Barger, is the number of victories that we have. It's not just to brag on the firm, but I think it goes more towards how many cases and matters the firm as a whole is handling at any one time. How many trials are we supporting? How many appeals we have pending? At my last two firms, busy, but oftentimes you only have a handful of big appeals going at one time. And so when you get a decision, a victory, it's a big deal. So it's only come every few months. Here at Wright Close, there's an email every single day about a trial victory or an appeal victory. And that's not to say we win every case, but we just have such a high volume of trial support roles and appeals going on at any one time that everyone here is busy and everyone here has lots of experience. And you can always find somebody to give you advice or answer a question or has been in a situation before that you don't know what to do.
One of the other things we wanted to talk about, and you alluded to it earlier, is the board certification process. And I know you took the exam last year, right before your clerkship, which, wow, I can't imagine. But just kind of walk us through maybe even just the process of getting started and the application and that kind of thing.
Sure. So I know in the past, you've had some appellate legends in the state on. You've had Robert DeBose talk about the history. I obviously don't have that experience, and I can't talk about the history of board certification and the development of the appellate bar. I think you had David Keltner on as well. So coming as a baby appellate lawyer, I knew from about my second or third year practicing law that I might want to focus on appellate law one day. And I knew that it was a specialty where being board certified matters. Not every specialty carries the same weight in your practice area, but civil appeals is definitely one of those areas where being board certified makes a difference in terms of getting business and even making partner at some places. And so that was something that I was interested in. And the board certification process is, you have the test, which is difficult, and I'll talk about that in a minute. But kind of the bigger issue is getting the experience needed to sit for the exam. And that takes many years to build up. So my first tip would kind of be to, for younger attorneys or attorneys that are thinking about being board certified, is to really focus on what type of experience you need to be able to be qualified for the board examination. And in addition to having practiced for 5 years, there are very specific experience requirements. And so what I did is I made a spreadsheet of what the different requirements are. So you can go to the Texas Board of Legal Specialization exam, or TBLS, sorry, the Texas Board of Legal Specialization website, and they have all these documents on the website. But I'm going to warn you that it's not the most user-friendly and it's not set forth in the clearest way. I think that's kind of the first hurdle in getting board certified, is whether you want to put the energy in to understand like what you have to do and what the test actually is. So you have to have handled 12 appeals where you handled all or a substantial part of the appeal. In addition to just that 12, there are other requirements, like you have to have 4 oral arguments. You have to, a certain number of them have to have been in the last 3 years. A certain number of them have to have been to final judgments. A certain number of them have to have been to the high court. So either the U.S. Supreme Court or the Texas Supreme Court in our case. And so you really just want to start keeping track of your appeals early on so that you know if you're meeting those requirements or not. So I would have like the list of the case. I'd have the year, because remember, you have to have a certain number within 3 years. At some point, the cases start to roll off and whether it meets all these various requirements. Something that I didn't do from the beginning that I wish I had was also keeping track of who your opposing counsel was, because that is information you need on the application. And it can be hard to go back and look that information up 10 years later. And then like a short summary of the case. So if you can get started with that early in your career, using that as a roadmap, that is would be a big, big help. How to get that experience? Ask for it. Work with your mentor, if you have one. Say, make it clear to everybody that you want to get board certified, because in our community, everybody appreciates and understands that. And they will really try to get experience to the people who need it for board certification. Don't be afraid to put that in your brief, in your reason for requesting oral argument. I mean, that's probably not going to be the only reason they grant oral argument, but the Court of Appeals justices do consider that when deciding whether to grant oral argument. If you're in Houston, the Houston Bar Association Appellate Section Pro Bono Committee is another great thing to get involved with. And I think there's other bar associations that do similar programs in the other courts of appeals, but get involved on that committee and make it known that you want to take cases. And those pro bono cases, you're going to get to argue them. So that was my first 2 oral arguments were pro bono cases. And it's still terrifying, but the judges know that you're doing it in the pro bono program. They know probably that you're doing it to get board certified because you put that in your brief. And so they're not going to go easy on you, but I think they might be a little more gracious with you and understand that you might be a little nervous because you don't have a lot of experience with oral argument. Once you finally get all those requirements in, you have to apply in the spring. They normally open the applications at the beginning of March, and you have about a month to get it done. The last 2 years, they've extended the deadline into April. So you have to go through and you have to detail all of your cases, the court, the cause number, the result, the opposing counsel, et cetera. And then you get your 5 references. So also be keeping that in mind, because they can't all be people from your law firm and they really shouldn't. And once you hit submit on that, you have 5 months or so until the exam, and you have about 2 to 3 months, maybe even longer, until you even know if you get to take the exam. In my opinion, the worst part of the process is this: do I start studying or do I wait? And the official answer is, of course, you start studying.
yeah. You can never start too early.
But it can be really hard to motivate yourself to study when you don't know if you're going to be taking the test or not. And you find out, I think it's in July typically, that you've been approved to take the exam. And I got the notification on July 31st. So it's like the very last day that they said we would hear. And I was convinced that I didn't get approved. And then I think it was like 5 o'clock on July 31st, I got the email that I could take the exam.
Oh, wow.
And so transitioning then to how do you actually study for this test? The test is on a single day in October. It has been at least the last few years at the AT&T Conference Center at UT in Austin. And it's a full day. In the morning, it's 3 hours of essays. In the afternoon, it's 3 hours of multiple choice. And the kind of most bizarre part of the process is that you are in a room with people that are taking all of the other subject matter board certification exams. So not everybody in the room, people next to you will not be taking the same test as you. Everyone has the same format, but everybody is taking a different test. I think there are normally, it's kind of a guess, but I'd say probably no more than 10 people a year taking the appellate exam, civil appellate exam. And when you go up and get your test and the proctor sees the subject matter, they're going to kind of suck in when they see civil appellate and appreciate you're taking one of the hardest exams there. So taking the exam itself is a kind of a surreal experience. Brings you back to your law school days. You're in a classroom that's stadium seating. That 6 month period between applying and taking the test is really where everything has to happen. the Texas Board of Legal Specialization gives you an outline for the topics to be covered on the appellate, civil appellate exam. And it is the least helpful document you will ever see.
I was going to ask you about that because my recollection of it was essentially it boils down to know everything about Texas appellate practice.
Well, it's not just Texas appellate practice. It's know everything about civil litigation.
They're still testing some federal too.
Yes, it's primarily state practice, but it does test over federal. The biggest issues with federal are kind of knowing where the federal system deviates from the state system, like where the differences are. But I have the exam outline here, and it's like 1, intentional torts, 2, negligence.
Yeah.
Like,
but you're right. I do remember there being a very heavy emphasis on civil procedure and not necessarily limiting the test to appellate procedure. And you're just bringing back flashbacks from many years ago for me, which was like that. You're right. That outline, as I remember, was the least helpful document I've ever seen.
Yes. I mean, you can't really fault them because
no,
it's an interesting exam. Most of the other exams are subject matter specific. But as we all know, appellate law is not a subject matter. It's more a procedural issue that comes up in any lawsuit. And so you have to know kind of everything about a lawsuit from the time it's filed to the time the mandate issues, which, by the way, that's something that I had never given a whole lot of thought to. And that is definitely on the exam, is what happens at the end of the appeal.
Yeah, it's important to know.
So, I mean, you have to know how you post a bond and how many days after the judgment does the mandate issue? And what happens if it's reverse and remand or reverse and render? And it is a lot of material. So my biggest piece of advice for studying is to think about how you studied in law school. You're the same person you were in law school. You maybe are more efficient now than you were then. But if you were the type of person that liked note cards, probably still going to be the best method for you. I guess it's a kinesthetic learner. I like to write things out, physically write them or type them. In law school, making the outlines themselves and then condensing them into a narrower outline, that was how I studied and learned best. And so that was true for the board exam. I took my O'Connor's Texas Civil, my O'Connor's Texas Appeals, and the federal versions, and basically I took the outline that TBLS gives you for the exam. I made a Word document out of it, and I went to each chapter of O'Connor's that was relevant to each of the topics and wrote a summary in my outline. And that took several months. For me, the making of the outline was the studying. But if you're a type of person that actually making an outline isn't how you learn best, you need to get it onto flashcards or you need to be teaching it to someone else, then I would recommend you get that outline done much sooner than I did, because you're going to need the time to actually make the note cards. Or there's some apps you can use that are similar to note cards. But I didn't really finish my outline until about a week before the exam. And for me, that works. But for a lot of other people, that might not be a good option. One other study aid that would be super helpful, and I actually learned about this from one of your podcast episodes, the Practitioner's Guide to Civil Appeals in Texas book that was put out by Robert DeBose as the editor-in-chief, but pretty much all of the Alexander DeBose Jefferson lawyers had a hand in it. It is a great resource for practitioners, but also it really is like, this is the material on the board examination. You really only study one thing, that would be my recommendation. I also just tried to like immerse myself in appellate law. I listened to y'all's podcast. I listened to CLEs when I was in my car and when I was walking. You have to have 60 hours of continuing education on topic to sit for the examination. And so another tip is that to do the 60 hours, you'll probably hit the requirements to join the Texas Bar College. Texas Bar College essentially means that you do significantly more continuing education than is required to keep your bar license. But once you join the Texas Bar College, you have access to the library of Texas Bar CLE materials, which is another good resource for studying. The materials from the Advanced Appellate Seminar that the State Bar Appellate Section puts on every fall, the 101 appellate course that the section puts on. And then there's also some other great Texas Bar CLE courses on evidence and discovery and civil litigation. Those materials are helpful as well. You will probably be eligible to join the Texas Bar College as a result of getting enough CLE in to sit for the exam. So take advantage of that and join the Texas Bar College so that, well, one, you're supporting the bar, but also you get access to all of the materials on the Texas Bar Library.
The timing of the exam being in October, I also remember one little bit of wisdom that's also a tip is make plans to attend 101 in the advanced seminar, which usually happens around Labor Day. So you've got the latest thinking of the people who are at the very cutting edge of what's going on in appellate practice. And that, I don't know if this is still the case, but when I was taking the exam many years ago, it was sort of seen as you would be stupid not to attend and study those materials closely and know what the issues are because those were frequently tested on the exam.
Yes, and I received that advice as well. I mean, I think anybody that practices civil appellate law should be attending the advanced conference every year, but definitely as you're preparing for the exam, attending the 101 and the advanced course is super helpful. On one hand, it feels like it's too close to the exam to be useful. It's like, I've already learned so much. What good is this going to be? But even if it's just review, sitting in that room and hearing these talks is studying. And so it's definitely worth the 3 days out of your schedule to go to Austin. The other course that's very helpful is UT. The University of Texas puts on a class in a seminar in June on federal and state appeals. It's 2 days as well. So I attended both of those the summer before I took the exam. And the UT course has a little bit more of a focus on federal appeals than the state bar course does. That was helpful. There's a lot of overlap between the two courses, which is good because you see, like, if this is being talked about multiple times, I better know it. If this is something that all these appellate experts think is important, then it's probably going to be on the examination. And a little plug for the state bar course. The 101 course and the advanced course both have a lunchtime brown bag presentation on the board certification process. You don't get CLE credit for it and you don't get free lunch, but you should definitely attend no matter where you are in your practice if you have not gotten board certified yet. If you're one of the Supreme Court clerks that's attending because you're required to go to the 101 course as a Supreme Court clerk, stay for the lunch. A lot of it's going to be some of the information that we talked about today, but there will be more. I'll be giving the talk at the 101 course. Somebody else will be giving the talk at the advanced course. But if you have very specific questions, I remember thinking at the lunch last year, you're getting very close to the exam. And so you start thinking about the practicalities of it, the logistics of the test. And so it can be really helpful to talk to people that have recently taken it. Like, what can you bring with you? What should I bring? A water bottle? Do I need a snack? Like the little things that start to bother you when the test is moving right away.
Yeah. I'm glad that you're actually presenting on that topic this fall because the recent taker of the test and someone who spent so much time thinking about it and preparing for it and clearly was well prepared for it despite the situation you found yourself thrust into right before the exam. I think I'm a great person to offer tips and lessons. And you've certainly given plenty of tips today in terms of taking the exam and otherwise clerkships and so forth. But as we wrap up here, we do always like to ask our guests if they would like to share a tip or a war story to sort of cap off our episode. So Kelly, do you have something for us today?
Sure. I was thinking about war stories. I don't have quite as much courtroom experience as some of your guests have had, but thinking back to that first trial that I got to be a part of in Marshall. So I had been working on the case for 6 months. They weren't sure I was going to actually go to trial. And even if they had me come to Marshall, they weren't sure if I was just going to be sitting back at our temporary office space, drafting the judgment matter of law or doing things like that. But the partner on the case decided, like the day before trial, that I should make an appearance and be ready to be in court if needed. So I file my notice of appearance. Then we're at pre-trial, and one of Judge Gilstrap's clerks comes over, says, "Are you Kelly Clark?" "Yes, Judge Gilstrap would like to see you." Everybody turns and looks at me like, "What is this about?" So I go back to chambers, And he said, anytime an attorney makes an appearance in my case, I Google them. And I saw that you recently graduated from Baylor. And I'm a Baylor alum myself. And so I just wanted to introduce you or introduce myself to you and say how great it is that the partners are getting a young attorney involved in the case and that you're getting to go to trial. And so I went back out and told the partner, said, what did he want to talk about? Introduce himself and say that he thought it was great that I'm getting to come to trial. And I go, okay, well, then you're definitely going to be sitting up here at counsel table. Yes. And absolutely. they were like, and you're going to handle the jury charge now. I was like, oh, okay. I've been working on it, but I was not sure I would actually be the one doing the charge conference.
Wow.
So to finish the story real quick, the last day of trial, the charge conference was set for 7:30 a.m. because he wanted to get it done before the jury showed up. And it's January in Marshall. It's cold and dreary outside. We're in like a motel. I look over at the clock and it's like 7:35 and I was still in bed. I completely slept through my alarm.
Oh, no.
Ooh. And I panic and I bolt up. I throw on my suit, no makeup, no shower, get in the car, drive straight to the courthouse. Fortunately, it's a small town, so it only takes like 5 minutes. And the senior associate on the case was like, where are you? I'm like, sorry, I overslept. I'm on my way. Fortunately, opposing counsel was also very late. I got there before him and the partners on the case weren't planning on attending the charge conference. This may be the first time they've heard the story, but I almost missed it.
It all worked out in the end. Yeah. Oh my gosh.
I will never oversleep for a trial or hearing again.
Oh gosh. That is a nightmare. Oh my goodness. Well, Kelly, it's been so great to visit with you. Mm-hmm. Thanks for spending the time. And we look forward to seeing you in September at the advanced seminar.
Definitely. Yeah.
Well, thank you all for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, presented by Butler Snow. If you're enjoying the show, please recommend it to your colleagues or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate everyone who has rated the show and otherwise supported us so far. To stay in touch, suggest topics, ask questions, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or tweet us at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.